Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Sometimes you just don't want to have to ask for help, especially financial help. Surely you have it within yourself to handle the crisis you've been dealt. That, in a nutshell, was Chile's reaction to an 8.8 magnitude earthquake. 3 days in, it knows better. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Microsoft, offering cloud computing for businesses with solutions for managing the transition to the cloud while managing costs for customers at microsoft.com/cloud services. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It is the first day of March. The death toll in Chile climbed past 700 over the weekend following that massive earthquake that ripped across the Pacific Ocean floor. There are reports of looting in the shattered city of Concepcion, Chile's second largest, and President Michelle Bachelet sent 10,000 soldiers into the area to restore order. Also today, the government issued its first request for outside assistance to the United Nations. Why did it take so long for Chile to ask for help? For some context, we turn to Kevin Casas Zamora. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Chile's president now says that she will accept help from outside the country. But, you know, over the weekend, the mantra seemed to be, hey, we can handle it. So can they?
It's doubtful. I was kind of surprised of their initial reaction, and I think it betrays a certain perception of their own country amongst the Chilean elite. Chile is a country that has done incredibly well over the past 25 years. And I guess that there is this perception that Chile is on the verge of becoming a developed country. And I think their initial reaction betrayed that perception, that they could handle that, that they didn't need anyone to meddle in the recovery effort, and that asking for help was for countries like Haiti, but not for Chile.
Can you give us a sense of how the country has changed over those 20 years or so, particularly when it comes to their economy?
Chile is, in many respects, the success story in Latin America. This is a country that over the past 25 years has had average growth rates well above 5%. That has consistently recorded fiscal surpluses.
And where's that coming from? Is that simply better money management, or are there more natural resources that they're tapping?
Obviously, copper is very important for Chile. I mean, to this day, copper continues to be about 50% of Chilean exports. But more generally, this is a country that has opened its economy massively to the world. Mm. That's something that is crucial in this particular situation. I mean, Chile has well above $25 billion stashed away. They've used some of the money to reactivate the economy over the past couple of years, but they certainly have a very significant cushion in terms of a whole bunch of resources that they can use to invest in infrastructure and in general in whatever tasks are required by the significant recovery that they have in front of them.
You mentioned that there's been a lot of economic growth in Chile. How much of that do you know went into infrastructure that perhaps contributed to the death toll not being greater?
I think why the death toll was as low as it has been, given the magnitude of the tragedy, it ultimately has to do with development in general. The glaring comparison between Chile and Haiti showcases very well why development matters. I mean, and it matters because it saves hundreds of thousands of lives.
What do you think the rest of the world, other governments, are taking away from how Chile has handled this crisis thus far?
My sense is that the most remarkable aspect of all this is that it comes in the wake of the earthquake in Haiti. Mm-hmm. And the contrast couldn't be greater. Really, in Chile, what we're witnessing is a state that works. Whereas in Haiti, the most glaring absence in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake was of a state at all. I mean, it was sort of a phantom state. Whereas in the case of Chile, you can definitely see what a difference a functioning state makes when a disaster such as this one strikes.
Kevin Casas Zamora is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Thanks so much for your help.
My pleasure.
Today, the head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation made another pitch for an independent agency to shield consumers from bad financial products. FDIC Chairwoman Sheila Bair insisted it would help community banks, not hurt them, as opponents have claimed. But there's talk in Washington that the Consumer Financial Protection Agency is DOA. So why is it that consumers themselves don't seem to care? Here's our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale.
Consumer advocates want an independent Consumer Financial Protection Agency to write and enforce rules against predatory lending and excessive interest rates. Senate negotiators want to establish oversight at the Treasury Department or the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. But Ed Mirzvinsky with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group says existing bank regulators have never considered consumer protections their primary responsibility.
Their first duty was to protect the banking system itself. Putting the new CFPA inside an agency that has failed for years to protect consumers is one strike against the agency.
He says the first priority for existing regulators would be the financial viability of banks. That's because regulators have become too cozy with banks, says Mike Calhoun with the Center for Responsible Lending.
Many of the bank regulators came to regard the banks as their customers. They're funded by fees that they collect from those banks. And so there's this competition for regulators to be friendly to the banks, to encourage them to stay with that agency.
Banks have the right to pick and choose regulators. They fear that an unfettered consumer enforcer could compel them to make unprofitable loans to people who can't make the payments or keep them from marketing innovative products. Senate negotiators are still aiming to propose a compromise this week. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
When we called City Hall in Vancouver, B.C. today, it took a little while to get a response. Not surprising, given all the partying after the Olympics closing ceremonies. A city spokeswoman did tell us folks there were a little burned out. We didn't ask her if that was code for hungover. But as Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports, that may be the feeling when taxpayers there get the final bill for the games.
Nearly $1 billion. That's just the initial estimate of Vancouver's Olympic debt, much of that from bailing out the Olympic Athletes Village, a project cursed by cost overruns. Sounds like a lot for a couple weeks of fun on the ice and snow.
$1 billion? Well.
Olympic scholar Robert Barney told me Vancouver's getting off relatively cheap.
That's not too much when I think of Athens, whose debt runs over $10 billion.
Barney says Vancouverites who woke up today grouchy over the city's big Olympic bill might ponder instead what they got out of the games, a new subway line and a new convention center, for starters. Vancouver's mountain biking mayor had promised to use the games to lure new green businesses to the city, but columnist Vaughn Palmer at the Vancouver Sun isn't holding his breath.
If you asked a lot of investors, they would say that local tax rates are pretty high in British Columbia, and developable property is hard to find. So you can't change that overnight.
Canadian economist Sewer Somerville says if the Olympic Games did have the power to attract new companies to their host cities, local housing prices would go up.
And basically, we find that there's no statistically significant effect.
Which leaves what columnist Vaughn Palmer calls the feel-good effect of hosting the Olympics, made all the sweeter by his country's overtime win against the U.S. in men's hockey. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Wall Street celebrated the start of a new month with gains. We'll have details when we do the numbers. It didn't take long for memories of the financial crisis to start fading away. Today we got a look at the latest figures on consumer spending, and we are saving less and spending more than we earn. And that means we're whipping out the plastic again. The Credit Card Reform Act went into full effect last week. The banking industry has complained that the changes imposed by the new law will cost card issuers a lot of money.
But as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports, they've already found myriad ways to make up for it.
I got an offer in the mail from my bank last week. It said, when I use my debit card at the grocery store, I get 2% cash back if I push credit instead of entering my PIN.
Can I use my debit card as a credit card? How do I do that?
Can I ask for your PIN number?
The money comes out of my checking account either way. So why is Wells Fargo so interested in having me sign? I asked Bill Hardikoff, CEO of LowCards.com.
If you enter your PIN number, the issuer makes less of an interchange fee.
Interchange fees are what a store pays the card issuer every time you use your card. If you enter your PIN, the card company collects a flat fee, about a dime. But if you sign when you use your debit card, the card company collects a lot more, about 2% of the purchase price.
Welcome to the war on cash.
Jeff Leonard is with the National Association of Convenience Stores. He says merchants have noticed all the card companies doing more to drive up interchange fees since the credit card crackdown. Interchange fees bring in more than $48 billion a year.
It's clear that the credit card companies have to find new revenue sources. One of those is going to be interchange.
Another one is going to be overdraft protection. New rules say card companies can't let you go over your credit limit, then slap you with a big fee, unless you sign up for overdraft protection. So card companies are trying to convince you to sign up. Josh Frank is with the Center for Responsible Lending.
One of the top issuers has actively started calling people. They tell people things like, oh, the federal government is going to take away your right to charge what you want and you need to opt into this.
New regulations will cost card issuers more than $20 billion a year. They've also taken huge losses from rising defaults. Nessa Fettis is with the American Bankers Association.
They're going to have to figure out how to ensure that revenue is higher, given that the new rules restrict the ability to get income in one area.
So we can expect to see more new kinds of cards and new kinds of promotions in coming months. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
And for a list of the new rules the credit card companies have to follow and some of the ways they're getting around those rules, go to marketplace.org. Get out the cake and candles, for today marks the 200th birthday of someone near and dear to my heart as a classical pianist, Friedrich Chopin. To think, if I had lived in 19th century France, I might have been able to take a lesson from him. But it would have cost me 20 francs to be exact, a pretty penny in its day. Our friends at the classical station WDAV in Davidson, North Carolina, looked into it for their series Radio Chopin. We'll call it Chopinomics. Jennifer Foster reports.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around.
Money, I'm a revolutionary. Money means nothing to me. A famous quote by Chopin. So just how much was a franc worth in Chopin's day? Debatable, but estimates range from $2.50 up to $4.80. That would put the price tag on a piano lesson with Chopin between $50 and $96. Sound reasonable for a piano lesson with the man about whom Robert Schumann shouted, "Hats off, gentlemen, a genius"? Hats off is right. Dinner's off, too, considering the average daily wage for an unskilled laborer in Paris in 1823 was 1 franc. That's 3 weeks' wages to pay for one lesson if you don't eat. In 1982, Chopin and the first two bars of this Polonaise in F minor appeared on the Polish 5,000 zloty bill. This year, the National Bank of Poland is adding their 2 cents worth with the release of a special collectible Chopin banknote valued at 20 zloty, about $6.77, 14 of the new notes if you want a lesson from the old poet of the piano. From Davidson, North Carolina, I'm Jennifer Foster for Marketplace.
Best ever. Coming up, do patients do better when hospitals have a little zen in their design?
They're resting and sleeping more than they ever have before, and the requests for pain medications are decreasing.
But first, let's do the numbers. Word that the government could be getting more of its bailout money back helped lift stocks today. The Dow picked up 78 points, about 0.75%, to close at 10,403. The Nasdaq added 35 points, 1.5%, to end at 2,273. And the S&P 500 tacked on 11 points, 1%, to wrap up at 1,115. AIG, everyone's favorite bailed out insurance company, said it would sell its Asia division for $35 billion. Not sure yet how much of that is coming back to the Treasury, but investors were happy. AIG shares rose more than 4%. And from the fat cat files, investment bank Goldman Sachs said it rejected demands by some shareholders to investigate the $16 billion it paid executives and employees last year. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. Throughout the trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Detroit, major automakers report sales figures for the month of February. The Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee takes a look at the government's response to Toyota's recalls. And the House Committee on Education and Labor holds a hearing on meals in schools. It discusses improving federal child nutrition programs. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. For the first time in 10 years, there was no State of the Black Union meeting last month. Led by talk show host Tavis Smiley, leaders from the African American community used to meet on the last weekend in February to discuss everything from the economy to politics, arts, culture, and beyond. But not this year, despite the recession's impact on that community. My colleague Kai Rizdal caught up recently with Dr. Julianne Malveaux. She's an economist and president of Bennett College for Women, and he asked her to outline some of the challenges for African Americans in this new decade.
Dr. Malveaux, good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
What, in your opinion, then, since Mr. Smiley has opted not to talk about it this year, what is your understanding of the state of the Black Union in this country?
Well, the state of the Black Union is, I think, on the brink and over the edge in terms of any number of socioeconomic indicators. I would start, of course, with the economy. We look at the unemployment rate. It's reported at 9.7%. That 9.7 for everyone is really 16.5 for everyone because of the discouraged workers and those marginally attached. But if you do the same kind of calculation with the African-American community, you come up with an unemployment rate that's about 28%. That's something that we need to talk a lot more about, but not only talk more about, but do more things about. President Obama, I think, is on the right direction with this.
Well, about the president for a moment, he has been criticized by many different groups since he has taken office who all thought that he was going to work more solidly for them. Is he doing all that he could, in your opinion, for the African-American community?
You know, the president is suffering from what I call the curse of high expectations. Everyone wants him to do something, and he certainly has come in raising people's hopes with that wonderful rhetoric of yes, we can. And then I would say this, if there were any other population in the United States that had an unemployment rate of 28%, I believe they'd get special attention. If this was a group of Appalachians, let's say, they say, okay, we've got to do something. This unemployment rate is so much higher than everyone else's. If it was women, say, oh, no, this is too high of a rate for women. So African-American people want to be treated the same way others are treated, which means when our problems are special, they deserve special attention.
Lay out some of those challenges. Be explicit for me. Where are the challenges economically for African-Americans today besides unemployment?
Other than the job market, there's the housing market. The whole foreclosure issue has hit us harder for any number of reasons. We were primarily renters, and so we were often renting from people whose homes had been foreclosed. So the renter has pretty clean hands. She's paid her rent every month, but now her landlord is foreclosed upon, and she has to go. Education and the whole issue of access and affordability in a recession is extremely acute. President Obama raised the Pell Grant by $650. We were very grateful for that. But when tuition, room, and board at a college like mine is $22,300 and the Pell Grant is $5,350, the question is, how do you deal with that? That's the kind of thing that hits the African-American community hardest.
Well, lay it out for me then. I mean, why has the African-American community been so hard hit in this country?
First of all, the African-American community experiences a historical discrimination that shows up with a wealth gap. A wealth gap means you have less to rely on when you have hard times. So African-American people, 13% of the population, have just 2% of our nation's wealth. Secondly, African-American households have lower incomes overall than majority households, and about 32,000 compared to roughly 50,000 for whites, and those are round numbers. And you have a high level of female headship. Families that are headed by women. Not all those families are families in poverty, but when you have one parent in a household, again, you have less essentially to fall back on.
If we called you in, say, 10 years and wanted to have a conversation about the state of the Black Union then, would it be materially different than it is today?
I certainly hope it will be materially different, but it will really call for work. If no one does anything different, it will be the same in 10 years.
Dr. Julianne Malveaux, she's the president of Bennett College for Women in Greensboro, North Carolina. Dr. Malveaux, thanks so much for your time.
Great, thank you.
And listen throughout this week for commentaries addressing some of the issues raised by Dr. Malveaux. We've all heard it. The most dangerous place to be if you're sick is the hospital. Every year, thousands of patients are admitted for one problem and end up with another. According to the Centers for Disease Control, so-called hospital-acquired infections cost more than $30 billion every year. And it all adds up to more expensive health care, not to mention the added pain and suffering for patients. As part of our ongoing coverage of health reform, The Cure, Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll looks at how one hospital is tackling the problem by design.
I sink into an oversized chair with velvety pillows and contemplate the Japanese garden outside. Sunlight pours in through big windows, and as the sound of piano music starts up, I shake myself and think, wait, I'm in a hospital.
The two comments we often hear is, it feels like Nordstrom's, or we feel like we're at the W Hotel.
Dan Gross is Executive Vice President of Sharp Healthcare. I meet up with him in the lobby for my tour of the swanky Sharp Memorial. It's a $200 million hospital in San Diego, and it's built with the principles of what's known as evidence-based design.
There's a lot of research today and a lot of conversation around how the design of a hospital really promotes comfort, healing, and produces better quality outcomes for patients.
Better outcomes, as in fewer medical errors, infections, and injuries. That saves hospitals, patients, and insurers a lot of money. Gross points to a row of elevators to explain how the building design works.
When we started designing our public transportation and our elevator system, we stole from the Disney concept of onstage and offstage work.
There are a separate set of elevators for the public to keep germs away from patients with weak immune systems. Nurses have private areas offstage where they can prepare medications uninterrupted, so there are fewer distractions and fewer mistakes. As we get in the elevator to see the rooms, Gross tells me that patients are more relaxed, too.
They're resting and sleeping more than they ever have before, and the requests for pain medications are decreasing.
Most hospitals are about as calm and relaxing as a busy airport. But at Sharp, the only noise you might hear is Dan Gross hushing some nurses as we get off the elevator.
Shh. Good morning, ladies.
At Sharp, loudspeakers are rarely used. There are no big carts rumbling down the hallways. Nurse Carol DeVito says she had something to do with that. Staff members like her weighed in on the design changes.
Actually, I said these are non-negotiable. Two things, very simple. One was a linen hamper in every room.
And the second thing was I asked if that we have like some kind of a cabinet or cart.
That way there's less need to move things. It's quieter and germs can't hitchhike on equipment as it rolls from room to room.
Here we're in one of our patient care rooms.
Dan Gross shows me the pullout couch for family members who want to spend the night. All the rooms are private. Heart surgeon Sam Baradarian says having a second patient in the room was distracting.
There was just a lot of noise. There was a lot of interruptions.
Now the families can focus on the treatment plan. This can help patients get out of the hospital more quickly and stay well when they go home, so they spend less to get better.
It's nice having a private room so you can speak candidly to the patients.
The single rooms, the extra nursing stations, and additional medical gear can add millions of dollars to initial construction. Blair Sadler is a senior fellow at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. He says the investment pays off.
Well, if something costs an additional $1 million once and reduces operating costs by $500,000 a year, year after year after year, the payback becomes pretty obvious.
Even small things like decorations can make a big difference. Derek Parker is a hospital architect and a co-founder of the Center for Health Design. He worked on Packard Children's Hospital at Stanford.
The artwork there, which is really museum quality, I discovered later it really isn't so much for the children as it is for the parents who wander the halls at night when the children are sleeping.
At Sharp, families have a comfortable place to get coffee, put their feet up, and gaze out at the garden. Even the beds play lullabies to help patients forget for a moment that they're in a hospital. If that helps patients relax, heal, and get out of the hospital faster, that's music to everyone's ears. In San Diego, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
And for a virtual tour of Sharp Memorial, go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Microsoft, offering cloud computing for businesses with solutions for managing the transition to the cloud while managing costs for customers at microsoft.com/cloud services. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, for those of you who've always wanted to go back in time, how about a little PlayStation 3? Today, Sony warned that clocks in some of the console's older models are resetting to January 1st in the year 2000. Y2K, only it's a decade late. Actually, it's just a glitch in the clock functionality. But Sony says gamers could lose data if they don't stop using the machines immediately. A fix is on the way, but till then, your high score in Pong will have to wait. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 78 points, about 0.75%. The NASDAQ picked up 35 points, more than 1.5%. And the S&P 500 tacked on 11 points, just over 1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, union troubles are threatening the town that Borax built.
By locking out their workers, the families in town, they're losing money. And when the families lose money, the community loses money.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.